Welcome to City Talks, a monthly podcast looking at the big issues facing UK cities and the latest thinking in urban policy. I'm your host, Andrew Carter, from the think tank Centre for Cities. I hope you enjoy the episode.
Today we're focusing on the perils and potential of Britain's high streets, town centres and city centres. And my guests are Chris Brown, founder and executive chair of Igloo, Julie Grail, founder of the BIDS business and senior fellow at the Institute of Place Management, and Rebecca McDonald, analyst at the Centre for Cities. Welcome to you all. So we're going to start with just getting your perspectives on what's happening to our high streets and our town centres and why we've got to where we've got. And then we'll move on to questions about how places are responding in different ways and what more needs to happen. So Julie, from your perspective, just give us a sort of snapshot of where we've got to in relation to high streets, town centres, and what's been going on over the last decade or so.
Okay, thank you, Andrew. Well, I think to start with, I would absolutely firmly put it in the context of town centres, not just focusing on high streets, because to me, that's actually one of the fundamental problems we've got. We've had so much focus on the high street and therefore retail as a kind of core driving function of town centres when it absolutely shouldn't have been. So kind of not to make a religious point, but to make an analogy, really. We've worshipped our cathedrals that have been retail centres rather than recognising what town centres should be. And we've had kind of heavily over-net engineered, very opulent shopping boxes for the last two or three decades, which has put a huge amount of investment in one central kind of element of our town centre, i.e. retail, which is now heavily floundering, and therefore our town centres are failing, when actually what we should have been doing is looking at the whole and managing the whole, and then dealing with one small weakness. So for me, there's kind of two or three decades of overinvestment in one sector, lack of investment in other sectors, which has then caused us some really fundamental kind of macro problems in our town centres. And for me, coming from a BID perspective, it's kind of silks purse, sows it. How can we properly invest and manage our strong places if they haven't got the basic needs, if they're not clean, they're not safe, they're not attractive, they're not accessible? They don't do the required components that we need in our town centres. So they leave us with really serious shortcomings. And just to kind of finish my starting point, which is how can we really manage these great places if these great places are no longer great? So many of our town and city centres are currently uncared, unmanaged repositories for our significant homeless problem in our country and a load of other community issues that we've got, and are really a reflection of the economic vibrancy or not, as the case may be, of the hinterlands. High street and town centre must not be looked at in isolation, we must look at the whole.
Yeah. And what's your take on, you know, why retail did become so dominant within the town centre conversation and the way that they operate?
Oh, well, here's another analogy. So for me, I think it's another real sort of reflection on society's drive in one direction. And let me give you an analogy. So we must consider our home and our foundations to be the most important thing about us, that basic need of food and shelter. But actually what's going on in society is we're kind of allowing our home's foundations to crumble, our roof to let in rain, whilst we still drive a smart car, we still want an expensive handbag, we still want to go on a luxury holiday, and we still want to consume grandiose coffee. And that's what we've been doing with our town centres. We've been allowing investment to go in one section of community, of society, that we can sorely afford, whilst the rain's letting in our town centre, but actually a load of retail's gone elsewhere online. And so we've got this real mismatch of investment and expenditure, and we've got to try and bring that back together into a community understanding of what a town centre needs to be.
Brilliant. Okay. Chris, your perspective on how we, you know, what it is it that we've got to and why we've got to where we've got to?
Yeah, I agree with all of that. And it was all both predictable and predicted. So out of town was the first undermining of the high street. And it is preconditioned on this idea that the high street has retail. I remember giving evidence when there was an inquiry for 10 out of 10 shopping centres around Greater Manchester in the mid-80s. And we predicted that Altrincham would be virtually destroyed by the out-of-town, and that's exactly what happened. So that was all predictable. The internet was then predictable, so it's, 30% online now. So the retail trade has moved, but I think we need to be careful because this isn't a problem of all high streets or all town centres. I think this conversation probably needs to be about failing town centres, because there are very, very successful town centres. They tend to be the bigger ones. They tend to be the ones that have the mix of uses. They are the destinations. And it's the ones with retail vacancy rates of 20%, 30%. Those are the ones that where the issues are.
Mm. Same question to you, I suppose, is to, in a sense, why did we let retail become so dominant in terms of A, town centres, and obviously being allowing that shift to out of town and edge of town stuff?
Yeah. Money, markets, it's my perspective is a property industry perspective. I remember, again, back in the day, this was probably early 80s, in Kendal, and it's a kind of, it's something we might come back to, but I was an estate agent specialising in retail. On behalf of a client who was a developer, we bought a shop in Kendal from an ironmonger who was retiring. We let that shop to WH Smith on a long lease with 5-yearly upward only rent reviews, and sold it to an institutional investor, a pension fund. You know, sort of people we invest our pensions with. And that was happening all over the country, time and time again. The weight of money going into chain store retailing in the high streets was massive. And it was, you know, it would have been very difficult to resist. And our high streets traditionally have been, you know, one shop's been owned by someone different to the next shop and so on. And so there's no one kind of trying to curate what's going on. It's just market forces on an individual transaction basis.
Mm. So there is, and yeah, I mean, that is a common issue, isn't it, in terms of, I suppose, the fragmentation of ownership on the one hand, and notwithstanding, you know, good works of town centre management and business improvement districts more latterly, no one really taking a kind of place perspective on the overall functioning of that, which is different from other, you know, other forms, which is often, you know, the comparison.
It's quite interesting looking at the top 10 shopping destinations in the UK. Are all owned by a single landlord, not the same landlord.
Yeah.
But each shopping centre has a single landlord. They can curate the offer in a way that town centre high streets just can't do.
Yeah. So, Rebecca, you've done lots of work on the varying performance, which Chris just alluded to. Just give us an insight as to, because as you say, it's not all town centres that are struggling. Some are struggling. Some are actually doing relatively well. So just give us some of the characteristics of weak and poor performance.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't think you would necessarily know that if you look at the headlines about high streets, or if you listen to the media, you know, it makes out that all high streets are declining, and that's kind of the inevitable direction of all places. But exactly, so if we go to somewhere like Cambridge City Centre, you've got a vacancy rate on the high street of just 7%. If you go to somewhere like Brighton, it's similar. Some of the large cities, exactly as Chris said, like Liverpool, the vacancy rate's 9% in the city centre. But then if you flip that and you go to Wales and you look in Newport, a quarter of the high street is empty. So you've got a really big difference between some of the stronger and some of the weaker places. And that variation is important, because that variation means that some of the normal narratives about what's going on don't quite fit. Because if it's online retail that's causing all of these problems, then you would expect that also Cambridge would be struggling, as well as Newport. You know, the benefits of online shopping are similar across the country. So that then kind of says, well, probably there's something else going on, another major factor. And that's where the kind of economic factors come in. And you think about the presence of jobs, and in particular well-paid jobs, in and around town and city centres has a massive impact on the high street. So not only does having more jobs there create footfall in a simple sense, but also if you have more highly skilled work, people in better paid work, then they have more money to spend, and to then go out and, you know, buy a coffee and go to a restaurant after work. So we see that city centres with a strong economy and lots of business investment like this are the ones that have low vacancy rates and can sustain their high streets. and it's places with few jobs in and around the high street, and in particular a lot of low paid work where the high street can't be sustained.
Julie, your reflections on that, and particularly, you know, the difference between when we see success or we see, you know, failure, as it were, you know, the how the macro and the micro are, you know, are playing out. You know, it's not a surprise in some regards that if we've had 10 years of stagnant wage growth, which we have in this country, disposable income is squeezed, and therefore, you know, people are, you know, choosing to spend their money more wisely, which is a kind of macro issue, versus, you know, the way that town centres function isn't particularly successful because of a bunch of micro reasons. But just give us your senses to that, particularly given your, you know, work on business improvement districts, town centre partnerships and all of that.
Yeah, I mean, I'd pick up particularly on Rebecca's point first, which is so important to recognise the town centre's vitality and viability very much reflects its economic hinterland. There's absolutely no two ways about that. Of course it does. But as Chris says, particularly important is we can see a number of highly successful town centres around the country where they are really, really working, they are really vibrant, and that's partly due to their scale of critical mass and their accessibility and catchment, and it's partly in the smaller locations due to the affluence of that community around. So in essence, what that tells us, where there is money, there is a successful model. And what we can say in bids, and we see very clearly, is where you're operating bids in those kind of locations, they can have a very, very strong curation function, mm-hmm. and they can really add value, and they really do absolutely kind of pay for themselves and add that extra value. What becomes very different when you look at the kind of contrary to that is in the generally smaller locations, but locations where they've had industrial decline, where they've had significant employment loss, and the general economy is struggling, broadly so does that town centre. And that's when you get into the challenges of how do you make the vitality of that place work when all it's about is creation? So if Altrincham's a good example of this, actually. It has a bid. It's just done a first-term bid. It's done some useful things, and actually most of its focus has been around trying to bring a sense of curation and leadership to the place around partnership, and focus particularly on the opportunity of the market, where there is a kind of potential burgeoning new economy around markets. But of course, when you're dealing with bids, you're dealing on a major city. At best, they've got just over £2 million a year in bid levy, which sounds reasonably significant, and it's pretty good in Leeds. You know, you can do quite a lot with £2 million, but you still can't do major things. Mm. When you go to the small locations like Altrincham, you're dealing with, they'll be collecting £250,000, £300,000 a year from a business community with a will and an ability. But if you've got major macro problems in that location, it's incredibly difficult to turn the tide.
Yeah.
And that's where we're struggling. What becomes more difficult to turn the tide is if we haven't got that basic level of investment. And we have too many town centres in the country at the moment that are sort of fundamentally failing from an economic point of view, and then failing from a basic care and safety regime. And we can't just therefore put a business investment on top and think we can solve it, because we can't.
Yeah.
We must get that basic underpinning. I've got loads of examples of bids where I'd say we're in the middle ground and they're making it better. I mean, Salisbury, Shrewsbury, Canterbury, all kind of mid-sized heritage town cities who are making a really good difference with bids, because they're not failing. They're not fantastic. They've got some struggle. Salisbury obviously had a significant struggle, but they can make enough difference, and they can almost be the kind of conduit for the conversation going forwards,
yeah.
for the kind of leadership proposition that needs to come together to go forwards. But you can't do that at the bottom level. It just doesn't work. There isn't enough money in the system.
Yeah. Chris, you'll pick up on that, but the micro, macro, you know, what's going on there? I mean, partly, you know, Igloo tries to think about how it intervenes almost at the micro scale in spite of the macro. In some respects, some of your locations would be, you know, classic secondary, tertiary locations if you were just looking at them on a map, wouldn't it? But just your sense on that.
Well, I'd just like to pick up a point from both Rebecca and Julie there, that we mustn't forget tourism in this.
Yeah.
So all the places that have just been referenced as either being successful or being less unsuccessful have all got elements of tourism, and that's an important part of the mix, and linked to that and linked to the proximity of office workers essentially, and I think there's a bit of a debate about cause and effect, but is about restaurants and food and booths, which has been growing for this three decades, and it's been masking the decline of retail. That's a long-term macro trend. And I think from our point of view, you start to get into the nuances of are you creating a destination? Are these destination restaurants, or do they rely on footfall? The ones that rely on footfall are struggling, but you can still create destinations. And what Nick Johnson's done in Altrincham Market is a classic example. And there, you know, Altrincham's, I grew up in Altrincham, it's not a tourist destination, but actually people will travel from quite a long way to go and eat out in Altrincham Market because it's now a destination. So there's a clue there about some of the things we can do to address our failing high streets.
So just to pick up on that Altrincham point, Chris, does it mean that if Altrincham becomes a destination, it's at the expense of somewhere else within the Greater Manchester locality, in the sense that Altrincham gets its, you know, its users from Oldham or from Stockport or from somewhere else?
Yeah, it definitely is a competition.
Right.
You probably, because this kind of, essentially it's a kind of food hall version of a market is new, you can't say it's taken away from this other food hall version of a market. What you can say is this additional spending has not gone to one of those other sectors.
Yeah.
So I think Stockport's probably a good example. And actually, if you look at the smaller high streets around there, you know, all the edge is probably doing quite well in a kind of similar kind of way, lots of restaurants. Wilmslow, which was traditionally much more of a retail place, actually started struggling back in the 80s when the after town came along.
Yeah. Because I mean, I think that this is one of the issues which we picked up in some of our work in a broader sense about cities doing well at the expense of towns, or towns doing well at the expense of other towns, or, you know, and there's a sort of sense that stuff is shifting around, but actually the size of the pie is, you know, is remaining kind of constant, particularly if ultimately you're after the consumer pound, which we assume, you know, is fixed at some, in some point. But I don't know, what's your thought on that,
Julie? Well, in fact, part of the challenge is that you're absolutely right, but part of the challenge as well is the pie is also being stripped away because it's going online too.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's this kind of curious thing from somebody that's been managing town centres for 20, 30 years. I could never quite get my head round the fact that retail's performance is entirely predicated on an expectation of year-on-year increase in sales. Well, at some point it's got to stop, hasn't it? Because it's just not realistic to keep doing that, especially if you don't adjust your basic retail model, which many haven't, and which is why they failed, as we know. I think what's really important is going back to that point of understanding how we rebase our understanding of town centres. What are the basic needs of a town centre? What is basically viable and necessary for a town centre to function for its own community? Recognising that beyond that, anything additional, any kind of bonus value, whether it's retail, whether it's tourism related, whether it's food and drink, is always going to strip some demand from elsewhere. So it's always a kind of shared competition, that element. And I think that's where we're floundering on the small to medium sized locations that think they can find something to share from somewhere else, but possibly can't, probably can't actually, stronger than that. And so we mustn't have these kind of artificially high expectations in many town centres. They can all have a piece of that pie because the pie's not big enough. And I think that's, coming back to sort of my bid world, that's one of the real challenges we regularly have, of this sort of desire for everybody, and dare I kind of just stereotype councils for a moment, but everyone from a council perspective wanting to ensure their place is the best place, and the most profitable place and the biggest place, without a context really of understanding the affordability and the vitality potential for that location. And I think where, particularly IPM's kind of approach into, with the recent winning of the task force from government, the approach of understanding community better, understanding the needs of places and trying to help in that leadership debate about what's realistic in each place, rather than every place becomes like the next place. That just isn't affordable and isn't realistic.
Yeah.
And we've got to try and understand rebasing, going back to the basics, and having those basic principles of, if our places aren't fundamentally clean and safe, irrespective of what else they've got, they're just not going to work, they're just not going to be successful. And we, through the bids world, can, you know, heavily invest in whether it be hot washing, chewing gum removal, etc., etc. But if our streets aren't just cleaned as a statutory base, this doesn't work.
Yeah.
Equally, we've got to be reliant on clean, on safe streets beyond that. So we can put rangers on the streets, we can put, you know, ambassadors, we can put a whole load of extra uniform presence. But if there's no police in the first place, and there's a significant homeless problem, and there's a whole lot of issues around antisocial behaviour that makes community not want to go there, there's no point in us putting the cherry on the top of the cake.
No. And that touches on, you know, bigger issues. Not all of those services are in the domain of the local government, but many of them are. And they, you know, over the last 10 years, as our research has shown, you know, they've received, and others have received, significant reductions in their overall budgets, which means that they can't. And the things that get cut are precisely the kind of things that you've just been alluded to.
And actually, one of our challenges, to be honest, I think about BIDS investment, having now had BIDS investment for 15 years into well over 300 locations across the country, is we are in danger of masking the weakness in budgets here, because we have been topping up investment, particularly in street presence, whether we call it rangers, ambassadors, wardens, whatever, and that's masking the depth of problems. If we take all of that away, we've had many bids over the first decade, subsidised or part-funded policing, for example. They're gradually stopping doing that now because businesses, in fact, can't see their value back.
Yeah.
So we must try and rebase the need of the police service first, and then look at what businesses can invest on top, rather than just expect businesses to complement and fund that for us, because we can't do that. It's not sustainable.
So you've been touching on it in various ways, but Chris, you start us a conversation on the sort of characterization of responses thus far to this chat. I mean, you know, give us a sense as to, you know, what the broad thrust of them, you know, you remember, go back to the Portis Review, which is really retail-led, you know, retail-led solution to a retail-led problem, which I think was fundamentally, you know, misunderstood, you know, she had misunderstood the kind of nature of the problem. But just give us a characterization of, you know, the responses that we've seen, and particularly, we'll come in a minute, I'm interested in your thoughts in relation to business rates, which is very close to the top of the conversation in nearly every place that we go to about why, you know, why places are struggling, which I have some skepticism about. But just gives a sense of the characterization of the problem.
Well, I suppose reinforcing the point you just made, everyone wants to have a Marks and Spencers in the high street, don't they? And that's just not going to happen. I think there is a property dimension to this that people probably don't understand, to be honest, policymakers at all levels. Rents essentially need to fall very significantly, and we're seeing this with company voluntary arrangements, you know, where rents are dropping, you know, on average maybe about 50% or something like that. That is the market value. You go to High Street now, and the rents are all over the place. There's the historic rent, which is quite high. There's the market rent, which is maybe half that. And in between, there are all sorts of other rents which have been set by individual CVAs around the country. So there's a kind of fundamental here. You can spread the retail spending, if that's what we're talking about, over a greater floor space, but only if the cost of operating that floor space drops.
Mm.
So that's one way of attacking it. And then the other thing about the model we developed was it was based on 5-year upward only rent reviews. And if you're an individual retailer, what that means is, because the rents are set at the highest rent that's ever been achieved in the high street, it means for the first 2 or 3 years you make a loss. And a retailer anyway is making a loss for 10, 11 months of the year and making all their money at Christmas. And then it's only in the last 2 years of the rent review pattern that you start making a profit. So you have to have a lot of cash flow. And essentially, an individual retailer can't do that. And so I'm interested in terms of responses to answer your question. Places like Holyhead, where they reversed that situation that I talked about in Kendal, you know, 30 years ago, and they were brokering the removal of the lease, the exit of the investor, and bringing in an owner-occupier who was probably going to go back to the whole model. They're going to live upstairs, they're probably going to run a lifestyle business downstairs, which might have a retail element, might be substantially online. Those are, I think, the future of some of the smaller town centres, that the retail element of the smaller town centres that can't compete.
And the stickiness or otherwise of rents.
Yeah.
Is that a reflection on an era that's passed, in the sense of those things will have to, you know, the model of all of that, which is significant. I mean, that'll be significant for the industry, not just for the industry, but then the investment industry as well. Right?
Yeah, and it's been going for a while. It's essentially gone in the office market. It's essentially gone now in retail, to be honest. Investors are going to have to recognize there's a lot more risk attached to investing in retail, because the covenants will be less financially strong, the leases will be shorter, and the idea that rents can only go up is history. So we're moving into a different place, but it's taking an awful long time, because investors just don't want to give up those upward owner equities.
Mm. And what's your take on, Rebecca to say something on, but what's your take on the question about business rates? I mean, I think there's several elements to it, but certainly there's a basic element, which is, you know, it's not fair that Amazon pays X business rates and, you know, retailer Y on the high street pays X plus 10 or whatever it might be. That's just simply unfair. There's that issue. And then there's the other issue, which is we need to reduce, you know, business rates as a take, you know, overall share, which I have some issues with in terms of tax incidents. But I mean, just your take on that.
So I may or may not have a bias on this, because that's how I started my career, assessing business rates for small shops. And it was a very weird system then, because it was based, this is in the early 80s, and I was dealing in a world of 1973 values, so it was very artificial. And we've significantly modernized our rating system. It's pretty much up to date. My view, and you can argue whether I'm biased one way or another, but it's a really good tax system. It's very hard to avoid. It does reflect values, and it is quite responsive to changes in values. My approach to this, and I can't remember, I think it's the government's policy, isn't it, at the moment, is you put a sales tax on internet sales. So you have to level the playing field because of the public good that we get from town centres, but you don't do that by reducing rates, in my view. You do that by increasing the tax on the tax avoiders of the online sales.
Right. Rebecca, say a little bit more from the work that we've looked at and others on, you know, the incidence of business rates or otherwise as a kind of inhibitor or problem.
Mm-hmm. So a few thoughts on that. I think firstly, which you've already alluded to, is the fact that will business rates cuts have a long-term benefit to retailers? Obviously, in the short term, there may be a boost from a rates cut, but in the long term, you know, it's likely that rents and costs will adjust to make allowances for those cuts, and therefore, will it really benefit them in the long term is kind of a question. Secondly, I guess one of my worries is that it ignores some of the underlying issues. So there is a reason why some retailers and some shops and services can't pay their business rates, and that there's a reason why they're struggling, and cutting business rates doesn't address those underlying problems, and in some ways can mask or let us be distracted from those. And those underlying issues in terms of what we've already spoken about not enough footfall or not enough spending power in the local economy, are the things that should really be tackled here, rather than looking to make life easier for those retailers in the short term.
Mm. I mean, it still seems the business rates conversation is still overly focused on retail. I mean, it seems to be almost exclusively the argument is we need to reduce business rates for retailers, which still seems to give a prominence to retail that you, and at least in the last half an hour, have suggested that was a mistake when we gave it to them in the first instance, and it's certainly a mistake now, given what we actually want our town and city centres to be like.
Yeah, and I think I would very much agree with kind of Chris's fundamental point in there about there's a need to even out and equalise the tax, but we've got a hiatus of issue around business rates at the moment because we've seen such a hiatus of kind of toppling of the retail model that we've had to date, and we're still on commercial catch up. And as Chris has said, you know, we're actually seeing fundamental change going on in there. Even it's monthly, it's not even in years, it's monthly on through these CVAs of just how much recognition there is now that rents have got to come down. So I think what we'll see, I'm afraid it probably is going to be a term behind, but I think what we'll see, next rating list will start equalising a little bit. The one after it will then really start evening things out and having a better reflection of where business rates should be in relation to the market. The problem, I personally think, although it's a difficult one to solve, is it in the rapidly changing commercial marketplace we've got at the moment, 5 years is just too long for rates reviews. It was fine for a long time because nothing was moving that quickly, and 5 year upward only rent reviews was all fine. It sat nicely. What we've seen with the 7 year, 2010 to 2017, was far too much of a spike and put enormous problems on people and just made that spike much more pronounced.
Yes.
And what we're gonna have at 2021 is a bit of evening out, but not enough evening out yet. Then it will start moving. So no, personally, I don't think changing and fundamentally rethinking the business rates, rent rate system is the right thing. I think it's just broadly a good tax, but we've got to reflect how kind of blunt an instrument is it is at this moment in time to truly reflect the market values, and that's what we've got to try and join up a little bit. And some of the suggestions of having annual rating list reviews, perhaps launch it, but my goodness, it's a high cost to be able to do that. We know, and I know from a big perspective, across the country, different areas are worse than others, but we've got significant valuation delays, albeit in a very good modernised system now. To have a rating system is fantastic to work through, and to be able to go online now and see values across the country in the public domain is very good. But we're operating in many locations in this where there's at least a 12-month lag on valuation coming in to
what's
authority.
The cause of the lag?
Lack of resource evaluation office, then a further 6 to 8 month lag sometimes of it coming into this onto the list in the local authority. That puts you 18 months lag in a system for bids where cash flow is predicated on an annual close from that for you, so you've lost the money and you never get it back.
Yeah.
So from an investment point of view in business, we're struggling to be able to do that in bids too.
Yeah.
So the problem is too big for a system that's too unwieldy at this moment. We've just got to try and adjust that to catch up again. And then
so would more regular reappraisal revaluations go into, you know, yes, we've gone from 5 to 3 to, you know,
That will help, but I think it's only needed for short term. I don't think it's needed for the long term, because I think we'll start seeing a different model come through. And, you know, the thing we haven't talked about at all yet, which I think will fundamentally change the way our town centres work as well, is agile working is becoming a massive thing. Millennials, it's almost the first question on recruitment. Is there agile working? Can I work from home? Can I work elsewhere? People don't just want to sit at a desk 9 to 5, Monday to Friday, which will change, therefore, the consumer habits, consumer spending habits. So we'll start seeing town centres operating differently, and then actually district centres operating differently. So we're just in this really commercial hiatus at this moment that we've got to respond to by increasing, you know, revaluations of rates, and by recognising the fact that, as the property market are doing, really recognising rents have got to come down, and we've got to relook at how commercial use is going to be in a town centre. But it's a relatively short hiatus, I think.
Yeah.
I think if we sat here in 5 years' time, we'd say, yeah, that's okay now. It's beginning to stabilise, and now we're beginning to see a new norm.
I really agree with that timing point. And there's kind of a fashion at the moment for what people are calling community retail, which is, you know, kind of bombed out malls in small centres, I think pound shops and things like that. I think there's a huge pent up reduction in rents in most of those assets. And I think it'll work out over the next probably 3-ish years, because these were leases that were entered into, you know, 5 and 10 years ago. And as they come up to expiry, I think because landlords have been clinging on to the upward only rent review pattern, I think a lot of those retailers who are just hanging in there at the moment will either disappear or they will say it's a 50% rent cut before we disappear, and the rates will then reflect that.
Yeah.
But it is that transition process.
And in a, from a policy point of view, do we, I mean, there's a sense of policy just has to wait through that 3-year period? I mean, or can it be shortened, or can it be amended? I mean, what's your, you know, if you're a local council with one of these thing, you know, assets, bombed out, whatever it might be, but you're waiting.
Altrincham has just bought both its mouths.
Yeah.
You know, Trafford, the council, has bought both of the mouths in Altrincham.
Yeah. Which actually lots of places have been, seem to have been doing as well, don't they?
A number of places have been doing.
Yeah.
I think from a policy point, from a central government policy point of view on rates, I would sit tight. I don't think, you can only adjust rates when you've got the rental evidence. And I think, you know, the next revaluation will be about right, you know, because essentially the evidence is in the lead up to that. And we'll get quite a big transition then. And as Julie says, the next one will be a big transition. So I'd wait on that. But in terms of what local authorities do, and Julie's point about agile working, so we're sat here around the corner from Bermondsey Street, which is essentially a new high street.
Mm.
So when we started working here, nearly 20 years ago, there were virtually no shops or catering outlets on this street at all. It's now an incredibly vibrant street. It's mainly food and booze rather than retail. It's got co-working spaces dotted along it. It survives, it's Rebecca's point. It survives partly because tourists and people from outside the neighbourhood come here because it's a really nice street, but actually mainly because a lot of people work around here and go out after work, go out for lunch and things like that. And there's a lot of clues there about how, I'll go back to Altrincham, about places like Altrincham have to transition, they have to get more jobs in, they have to get co-working spaces. It's got a great future as Altrincham if it can be managed well through this transition.
Yeah, so I mean, carry on that theme in a sense, if, you know, if the past was retail dominated, that's come to an end, or at least it's coming to an end, at least in the way that we envisage it formally. What's the future for our city centres or our town centres? I mean, you know, Igloo again has been in that sort of space.
Yeah.
City centre or urban living has been part of the story. Urban working, but in a much more flexible form. Some of the, you know, we've seen this in different examples, get different places from Rebecca, but what's the future in terms of that?
And we also have a sister company called Create Space Management, which is primarily in kind of Northern Powerhouse business running managed workspace. So we're quite well exposed to that. And so for me, you know, I don't like to look too far ahead. I suspect we might be past peak stuff. So I suspect kind of retail might have another blow coming. But for me, it's co-working spaces, which can be anything from a cafe to a WeWork, a huge range of different offers combined with food and booze primarily is the future. The thing that worries me is a lot of chat from politicians and local authorities, which is that the future is about libraries, public services, things like that. They don't add excitement to a place that is going to pull people from a wider catchment. So for me, you've got to be really careful about who's managing this process.
Mm.
You need people who are creative and entrepreneurial rather than people who are deliverers of public services.
Yeah. And
picking his words carefully.
I mean, that view that you've outlined, I mean, that obviously works for, you know, Bermondsey Street. It probably works for central Manchester, central Leeds, you know, some of our bigger places, more, you know, vibrant places already. I mean, is that a valid vision and perspective for Mansfield, to pick a random place that, you know, we know reasonably well? I mean, or are there elements that, you know, I mean, again, get your thought on that, you know, sense of, or is there something
different?
I think
the thing we'd all agree on is each town is different.
Yeah.
So you've absolutely got to craft your response to the conditions. We're doing some work in Jaywick at the moment, which is the country's most deprived place. most deprived neighbourhood. It's essentially a small freestanding village slash town outside Clacton. Mm-hmm. Clacton just got some high street money from government. Clacton and Jaywick actually have got some enormous potential strengths in relation to tourism. They've got fantastic beaches, but they have got primarily low-income retail catchment, because the higher income people tend to migrate to the bigger towns inland. So the response is going to be different in Clacton to in Mansfield. In Clacton, I suspect it's going to have to be much more about how do we increase our tourist pound, rather than particularly focusing on retail. Mansfield, I think, is tough. I've got some history in Mansfield as well. I think Mansfield is more of a Holyhead, so it's much more how do we transition the chains and the institutional investors back to owner-occupiers, people who really have an emotional as well as a financial investment in their place. And people, for those who know Jane Jacobs, will choreograph the sidewalk ballet, you know, who feel a kind of social responsibility for what's going on in their town. I think that's the future of places.
Yeah, and Rebecca, just gives a sense as to, Chris made the point, we completely, you know, echo it or say it practically every day, you know, places are different and therefore they need different responses. But you do see different responses going on in different places up and down the country, at least the places that we look at.
Yeah, completely. So I think looking at what the makeup of the high street will look like, as you mentioned already, there will be more of a move towards that food, drink and leisure. And we're already seeing that in the stronger places. So if we bring in some stats here, we can see that in the stronger city centres, about a quarter of the high street is food, drink and leisure, whereas that drops to just 15% in the weaker places, and that's replaced with a lot of shops. But we know that a lot of those shops are empty. So there will be something about moving more towards that space. But as you say, like, if there isn't the local economy, so take Mansfield for example, even if there's great management and the town centre is changed in terms of its makeup and there is more food, drink and leisure, if there isn't demand for that, then that in itself is not going to work. It's going to be empty in itself. So that's where the kind of looking beyond the high street thing comes in. So for places like Mansfield, just looking at the management of the town centre isn't going to be enough. They need, you know, it's going to be about trying to get better paid jobs and more jobs for the people of Mansfield alongside any improvements in managing the town centre. Another example of some different places which are again on the weaker economy kind of side, when we're talking about trying to get a more diverse mix of space, including more workspace, co-working space, flexible space, because rents are so low in some city centres and town centres, that's obviously not possible through the private sector. So we have seen some councils try to get involved in small ways to try and trigger the creation of some workspace and to create more of that diverse environment. So if we look at places like Bradford or Huddersfield, in both of those places the councils have been active with other stakeholders like the Chambers of Commerce to try and develop or partner to develop some small co-working or office spaces. You know, we're not saying that on its own creating lots of office space is the answer, but there was in those places some demand for it and that wasn't being fulfilled. So by very careful kind of small development, they were able to provide some space for workers and bring people back into the centres of those places. And they saw that businesses that were previously in business parks were now moving into the town and city centres, and that obviously will help with the high street.
Mm. Julie, just to carry on this kind of, you know, in terms of your experiences on bids, you know, how they're rethinking their, you know, their focus and how that's translating into, you know, different decisions on what the town centre or city centre is?
Yeah, I think right at the core of this that Chris just picked up on again just now is we must understand the indigenous population and culture of the locality we're working in first and foremost. We mustn't try and put a round peg in a square hole. So we've got to understand what's there, and what has the potential to be there, and then try and manage that evolution. And I mean, it's interesting, we've got this far in talking about town centre, we haven't talked about parking yet. And, you know, I find the whole thing infuriating, the parking debate. It comes up in every single location I go to and talk with people about. But the issues are different. So if you understand the Indigenous population and their culture, it's absolutely okay for a major city that's the destination and that has everything that you want to go for and is clean and safe to charge a high rate for their parking. No one's going to question it, are they? You know, you for individual single purchases via Amazon or any other online route, don't bat an eyelid to pay £4.99 per delivery charge for one item. It's madness, and yet we'll pay £13 for parking. So when there's not price sensitivity in a major location, that's all fine. However, you get to a smaller location and you've got all of those faltering issues and there's still a high car parking charge and most of those people are coming by car because you're in a rural hinterland, etc. It just is a major barrier. And so the way local authorities are currently set up, car parking is a useful income. They politically find it near on impossible to lose, particularly whilst their budgets are so, so strapped. And I really dislike that mechanism that almost sort of disables them from changing the parking pricing. Very small locations that need to rebase and are about functions rather than destinations cannot have those big financial obstacles. So for me, that is really about understanding the needs and aspirations of locations and how the kind of vitality of it works. There's a couple of other things I think probably worth mentioning in that as well, is when you think about, when you try and understand the local population and their hinterland and their potential kind of catchment, it is about kind of the demographics of it too. So we know that the millennials and younger generation are, you know, one of their biggest potential concerns and problems, and an enormously evolving problem is health and well-being. Mental health is a major issue, and that's largely brought about from online activity, from researchers now showing us, and it's obvious, we know the kind of things that they're struggling with. They're also struggling with lack of employment. But to be able to get to a better understanding of community activity that alongside agile working, rather than focusing efforts on some community retail that's actually a little bit warped because it's manufactured rather than need, you put people and activity together and you start trying to resolve some of those things. It's about thinking local, it's about putting service functions for people alongside commercial functions. And that's ultimately what a town centre was right at the beginning, way back when, before we got kind of, you know, global investment going on. And that's where we try and need to get back to. And that's not in every location, as we said, but certainly in smaller locations, we have to try and unlock the financial decisions of local authorities to be able to think like that. And at the moment, they can't.
And is it your sense, all three of you, that those insights that you've just set out are, you know, in many places, in the sense that, you know, there are lots of places now that are in this space thinking about that. Oh, actually, are we describing exceptions? And actually, the general rule is, you know, lots of places aren't thinking like that. They are still very much, you know,
many places like that. Many places like that. And that very basic one, it's an easy one to pick on, the car parking income. We need to disable local authorities from having to think like that, because anyone, and I'm a, you know, huge town centre proponent, if I was a councillor in those locations making the decisions they're making, of course I would also be supporting social care and education and mental health support. Of course I would, because they are actually more important on the face of it here and now. But they're, what's critically important longer term is that we've created a commercial functioning centre that then supports its community, and that's what we're currently breaking.
Yeah, well, as you say, you know, in the work that we've done, when we looked at urban authorities across the country, now more than 50% of those urban authorities spend more than 50% of their budget only on social care. And if you went back 10 years, that number is less than 10%.
I think you've got, as Judy said, local authorities all searching for answers, but I think it's worth talking about not so much the exceptions, but the leaders.
Yeah.
The one I like is Sunderland. Their new chief exec there, new strategy for the town centre. using their own money very creatively because they can borrow cheaply, and if they're investing that in income producing assets, actually that's a sensible thing to do. It helps the social care budget as well. But they're looking to, their history, if you like, was manufacturing in the town centre. That went in the 70s primarily. In the 80s, all the office work went out to the business parks. Now, all that stuff is reversing. There's even some manufacturing coming back. There's, you know, it might only be craft breweries, or actually very important craft breweries, but also they're looking at things like free ports and manufacturing modular homes. They're bringing the office space back from what are now out of date business parks that staff don't want to work on. They want to work in vibrant town centres where they can go out for coffee. So they bring the coffee back in, they bring the people with money to live, they're having housing. You know, these are big scale moves, but they will over a couple of decades be successful in transforming Sunderland.
Yeah. And I mean, Sunderland, you know very well, my colleague is from that part of the world, keeps a close eye on what's going on in that. In terms of, are there big policy plays that would help? You know, in a sense, you know, we're not kind of thinking about, you know, we see some of this stuff happening. Some of it happens in spite of the system, not necessarily because of it, or because, you know, leaders of exceptional quality have made tough decisions about, you know, you go to Exeter, making positive decisions about removing car parking space, even though it's an income, because they recognise the future is actually about the place being somewhere to live and to work, not necessarily to drive and park your car, you know, for 8 or 9 hours a day. So you see these kind of leaders of exceptional leaders doing great things, but are there policy plays, either, you know, a planning perspective or a fiscal perspective, that would make this just a bit easier?
Absolutely, there are. So you can put down, in my view, a number of things that have happened in this country politically over the last 10 years, down to 2008, when Gordon Brown essentially switched off the tap of transfer of money from wealthy places to less wealthy places. And that money was primarily being spent on transitioning those places from the old economy, manufacturing economy, to the modern economy. For me, I would be doing that again. And I do find the Future High Streets Fund, which appears to be kind of predicated on, you know, you've got to find match funding from local authority and from private sector. And I'm not sure that's the right mindset. For me, I'd be saying, what's the gap? You know, if you want to build new offices in your town centre and they're worth less than they cost, what's the gap that we have to put in as the state to help you make that transition? And it is only transitionary, you know, this is not a subsidy forever, it's a one-off, make the transition, turn the place around, and then it becomes self-sustaining.
Yeah.
And picking up on that, one of the things that is seemingly just so difficult to do, and there's such a reluctance, but we've got to lose this protection of Zone A frontages, this absolute incessant need to see extreme Zone A across the town centre that sorely can't sustain that level of retail anymore.
Just say what Zone A is.
Sorry, pure retail, so pure shopfront retail. And certainly, you know, beyond that, even the banks sector has shown us, you know, who needs to use the high street anymore for banking. So we've seen an enormous contraction of that. We're seeing it through a variety. We've seen move from retail into food and beverage, but there's still this incessant kind of expectation on seeing trading frontage uninterrupted. Lots of European countries don't know about that. It works perfectly well. I think as we see, and that Birmingham is actually a really good example, it's when you see agile working and you see more of a community operating sort of commercial state, you don't need that complete protected frontage. It doesn't need to work like that. France doesn't work like that. It's never worked like that. So we need to kind of break that pattern. Equally, permitted development rights saw some movement from commercial to residential. I think whilst unwanted in some locations, very much wanted in terms of the rebalancing of need.
Yeah.
We're not seeing it from retail to residential, but because of the nature of the build of those ghost town shopping centres that they're going to be have to knock down and rebuild rather than reuse. So we're still seeing that kind of temporary arrangement where there's an attempt at having some kind of meanwhile use in a shopping centre that won't come back in its current form. It will need either significant refurb or a rebuild, and we need to see that movement from residential, from retail to residential.
The French example is brilliant because they have a planning rule which protects bakers where the bread is baked on the premises. You know, actually, that's exactly the sort of thing that our high streets are looking for at the moment.
Adopting more French rules and regulations, that'll go down very well with some of our some listeners, I'm sure. Rebecca, thoughts on policy plays, things that we want to see to make this in making these sorts of transitions?
Yeah, well, something Chris said made me think that in the sense that a lot of the town and city centres that have been trying to develop more office space or more workspace in various forms have previously used the European Development Fund money, and obviously now if we're not going to be able to use that money, then the government is going to have to step in and provide some alternative funding, which is why things like the Shared Prosperity Fund should be looking at funding this kind of thing, and other funds like the National Productivity Investment Fund, they need to think more about city centres as a very important kind of asset and area. And given that city centres and larger town centres house some of the country's most productive and most innovative firms, it is really important that policy thinks about those areas really strategically when thinking about funding.
So to close, you kind of give just your thoughts on, I suppose, to Chris's point, I'm with you, you can't look too far into the future, but in terms of, you know, optimism about the nature of the level of understanding and the insights that we've got in terms of the challenges that we face, we see some emergence of thinking and indeed practice in terms of how to respond, but, you know, sort of rolling that up and scaling that up in terms of optimistic, Chris?
I think we need to be really clear as a society what we think town centres are for. And for me, they're social spaces. And that's something that I would like government to be prepared to invest in, because I think if the purpose of government is to maximise the well-being of society, this is an area where probably they get quite a lot of bang for their buck.
Yeah.
So I think getting a national consensus about, which I think is there actually, if I'm honest, about what town centres are for. And then my lack of optimism comes in whether either markets or government can actually get us there. I'm enthusiastic relatively about putting money into the hands of local actors. I really hope it doesn't just turn out to be the local authority and actually bids, business groups, community groups, get access to that cash and are able to spend it in creative ways, because I think those people can unlock their
centers. Yeah. Rebecca, thoughts on the future, optimistic in terms of the practices we see or the places that we engage with?
I think there's reason for optimism when we see that there are places where the town centre and the high street are doing well, and I think that shows us that, you know, the decline of the high street isn't inevitable, and actually we can look to those places and use lessons from those places when we're trying to help places where they are declining. But I think a lot of this will depend on whether there is more of an acknowledgement on how the underlying economy and the strength of that links to the high street. And I hope that we can move away from always talking about the high street, the retail, the stores, the restaurants, and think of it within a wider economic context, and think about jobs, and think about, you know, putting money in people's pockets and giving them higher living standards, and that then impacting the high street as well.
Good, Julie.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. We must remember we're a very advanced country. We should be in a position where we can understand and acknowledge we need to share our wealth well in a relatively balanced manner, so that, you know, that rich tapestry of uses we need and want in town centres with all those kind of intertwined activities can create appropriately vital and viable places. Now, I wholly believe, because it's what I do for a living and reflect some of what Chris has said, that is about local context, it is about local understanding, therefore there must be a sense of local leadership, and that local leadership must be multifaceted, it mustn't be local authority only, and whether that's through a bid or through a business relationship, it must be multifaceted. I guess I'm relatively optimistic that I think we're going in the right direction. We've got a government that is recognising the need to invest in it. We have got this support for High Street. We have got the support for High Street Task Force, which is about being predicated on local leadership, which is good. My massive word of caution is I really worry about those basic macro things not being funded. Clean streets, safe streets, they are absolute fundamentals to an advanced country that should ensure their streets are clean and safe. And there is no sign at the moment of increased, desperately needed, increased investment in our police service and in our basic kind of cleansing regime of town and city centres. And if we can't get those bits right, the rest is kind of irrelevant. So we mustn't see all of that expectation being on business investment. Business won't fund that bit without seeing something else come first.
Very good. My guests today have been Chris Brown, Julie Grail and Rebecca McDonald. Thanks very much for being part of City Talks.
Thank you for listening to this episode of City Talks, brought to you by Centre for Cities. You can find us on iTunes and Stitcher by searching Centre for Cities. Please rate, review and subscribe if you liked what you heard. You can also follow the Centre on Twitter at Centre for Cities, or like us on Facebook and LinkedIn for the latest updates on what the Centre is up to. If you have any comments on the episode or suggestions for topics we should cover in the future, we'd love to hear from you. Do tweet us or send an email to info@centreforcities.org. The music was from Palace Fires by Johnny Foreigner, used with permission, and all rights are reserved.